The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
When Nicole Sandler sits down to do her show, she's the producer, booking the guests, pulling the audio, planning the show, the engineer, running the controls, troubleshooting any problems, playing the sounds, calling the guests, and she's the webmaster, writing the blog, posting the podcast, maintaining the website, not to mention the host, interviewing the guests, explaining the issues, giving opinions, and calling out the bad guys. And then you get the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
Oh my God, it's only Monday and I'm already exhausted. All right, well, welcome to it. It's a new week. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. I got to tell you one thing that I did, that we did, David and I. There's an exhibit at FIU, which is Florida International University, and their main campus down in Miami. They've got a beautiful museum. And at this museum, damn it, I didn't bring the book in here, is the Bob Dylan Retrospectum. And you know I'm kind of into art these days. Well, Bob Dylan is an amazing artist, painter, and iron worker. I mean, he does these like iron sculptures too. Just magnificent. So the museum is basically filled with works of Bob Dylan, and it's gorgeous. Now, if you're on Facebook, go to my Facebook page. It's just N. Sandler. Not the show page, but my personal page. And I posted a bunch of photos there. And then I shared David's post because he took a million pictures and he posted them all. But you should see it. It's here in Miami until, I want to say, the middle of April. So if you're in South Florida, go see it. I think tickets are like 12 to 15 bucks or somewhere in there. It's magnificent. And you do get this lovely little book that I don't have in here with me. But anyway, I wanted to let you know before it escapes my mind and I get on to other things and I forget to tell you, because it is really good. And here comes David with the book. I love having this produced. So they give you this little booklet. It says Bob Dylan Retrospective. Yep, 30th November of 2021 until April 17th of 2022. And they have photographs of most of the works in here, although you got to see them in person. I got to tell you something. My paintings behind me, even my biggest canvas that I paint on, is tiny compared to the canvases that Dylan uses. Like, I'm holding up one thing to the camera. You can't really see it. But this is a three canvas painting of a road in what appears to be the Arizona desert at sunset. It's just gorgeous. And these three panels, they've got to be each 6 feet high. Just magnificent. And so again, I'll put a link on the blog today to the Facebook post where these images are. Oh, Winston, you like the window behind me. Thank you. And you can't even really see it because it's not backlit. Those windows, I did a new stained glass, faux stained glass window. This piece is already sold, by the way. But you really need to hold it up in front of a window to get the full magic of it. This is my new thing. So I've been on a quest to find old windows, old wood windows like that. This one is really special, and it's not really a window, but I do have, I think I've got four big old windows that came out of houses in the garage. So I'll be working on those sometime soon. If anyone wants a custom faux stained glass thing, we can talk. Anyway, enough of that. So yeah, that was my weekend. I unplugged my escape from the war was going to this museum on Saturday and seeing that beautiful exhibit and painting. I did a lot of painting. You see the one if you're looking at me, it'll be to your right, but on my, well, behind me, that one. The few of them are older, but there's one new one up there. And I've got two more that are almost done. So watch this space the rest of the week and you'll see my completed artworks. All right. I'm speaking cryptically to those who are listening to just an audio stream and not the video. So I like to try to make it colorful audibly as well as visually. So let me share with you. I know I get a lot of emails from people who've asked about Tatiana. So in case you don't know, who Tatiana is. I called, I think it was the day after Putin's armies invaded Ukraine. I decided I needed to call someone over there again. I had called before the invasion and spoke to a clerk at the Intercontinental Hotel in Kyiv. And I tell you, I can't stop thinking about this woman. A woman answered. She seemed completely not worried at all. She's like, nah, you know, they may come and they'll hit the east, but they'll leave us alone here. And I just, you know, now I can't help but think that this poor woman must be saying, oh my God, I got that call from that woman in America. And she knew this was coming. And I hope she's okay. So anyway, after Putin had invaded, I thought, you know, there are still people staying in hotels. And rather than call a big international hotel chain, I thought, let me call a smaller, you know, independent place. And it turns out that in Kyiv, there are a lot of hostels. I know them as youth hostels, but I guess they're not only for the youth. They're inexpensive hotels. And this one was called Friends Forever, written in English. So I thought, okay, maybe I'll get someone who speaks English there. And I called. And sure enough, the woman who answered the phone is a woman named Tatiana. It turns out she and her husband own the place. And she was a little freaked out when we spoke. We only spoke for a couple of minutes because she had to go back down into the basement where they were having shelter from the bombs. Not the storm, as Dylan would say. In this case, it's raining bombs. So, you know, when she was on the air with me, she said, well, send me a message using Telegram. And at first, I wasn't exactly sure what she was talking about because I'm kind of, you know, old and out of it. But a few of you listeners informed me, oh, Telegram is a encrypted app. So sure enough, I got on Telegram and I contacted her and we are friends. Okay. I think perhaps it's comforting for her to have somebody, again, out, you know, in the U.S. she's in contact with. So she knows the outside world cares and we're thinking about them. For me, I don't know if it's better or worse. I just like having one person that I can concentrate on, that I can worry about, because it's easier than worrying about the millions of Ukrainians as nameless, faceless refugees. But if I can think of one person, and I have that person now, Tatiana, and we text back and forth all the time. So we did over the weekend. Let me share a few of our exchanges with you. And by the way, just so you know, I again asked her today if she, you know, I said, no pressure. Whenever you're ready, I know my listeners are as concerned about you as I am. We want to hear from you, but I don't want to pressure you. I want you to feel whenever you're ready to talk, we'll talk. We can do it over a video. And what she said when I asked her that on Friday is sounded like she's shell-shocked. And I'm sure she is. And she's, when they got to the place where they're staying, they're in a remote village that is much closer to the borders of Poland and Hungary than they were in Kyiv. So they're at least, if the worst happens, they're closer to the border so they could get out. But right now, she's not leaving because she doesn't want to leave her husband. And I understand that. Look, men between the ages of 18 and 60 are not allowed to leave Ukraine right now because they're needed to fight. And it sounds like that they want to. Let's see. So when I spoke to her yesterday, so let me share a little bit of our back and forth from yesterday. I wrote, hi, I hope you were able to relax a bit at your friend's house. The civilized world cannot allow this to continue. I think of you constantly and hope that you're safe. And she wrote back, and this was noon yesterday, our time. She said, hello, I sleep very much and understand that I was not inadequate and shock all this time. She realized she's been in shock. I'm very poorly mentally, she wrote. And what was the last 10 days with me was the autopilot. And then she said, we have been here for 2 days and I have never gone outside, no energy and no desire. And so, you know, I said, you know, earlier in our exchange, she said, oh, I wish I could give you a hug. And I said, I responded to that by saying, well, now I'm the one who wishes I could give you a hug. I'm sure you're in shock. I'm glad you're able to get some sleep. Your body and mind surely need it. And then I asked her about the where she is in proximity to the border and everything. And she said, well, they were joined by her friend, her girlfriend, and her child. She said, if everything is bad, the husband wants to send me to Poland with her. And then she said, we're about 200 kilometers from the border, but people here stand at the border for 2 to 3 days. And so then we exchange more personal stuff. We're talking about birthdays, and she's 35 years old. Let's see. She talked about her family, and we both lost our mothers at very young ages. And she said, when I was 14 years old, my mother fell ill. I took responsibility for my younger sister. She was 6 years old. My mother died when I was 15. I raised my younger sister as a daughter. So, you know, we connected on that level too. And I sent her a link to my adoption journal because I adopted my daughter from Kazakhstan, and we went back and forth. And then I asked her, I said, I'm so sorry. I know how it is to lose your mother so young. I said, that's terrible. How's your sister now? And she said, this is sad. She said, my sister is already an adult girl. She's 28 years old. She lives and works in Dubai. She is now breaking her heart for us. And at first I wasn't quite sure what she was saying, but she's saying her heart is broken for us as well. She's, you know, feels like I do on the outside looking in, wishing she could help. And then she said, and see if this sounds familiar to you. And our dad has been living with another family for more than 20 years in Russia and watches TV with their information and does not believe what we have happening. It's like he's watching Fox and he's getting all this fake news because the people in Russia are not believing the news out of Ukraine, not believing what they're hearing. So again, I asked her where she was. She sent me a map so I could see where they are. The Chernobyl region, the Chertovsky district in this little village. And then I'm going to show you some pictures she sent me. So those of you who, again, if you're watching on a video feed, then you're in luck because you'll see these photos. So she had said that she was going to be, hold on, why can't I get this up there? Wrong one. Here we go. All right. Huh. Okay. I need the top. There it is. All right. Now I see. All right. I'm going to be able to show it to you this way. I'm juggling four screens here and figuring out how I can best show you these pictures. Okay. So if I bring this one up, all right, this will work. Bear with me 1 second, everybody. I am trying to do this. If I do this. I know this is not great radio, but it'll be worth it when you can see these photographs. Why is that not going? Oh, okay. I thought I did. Honestly, I thought I did this before the show, but it turns out that I didn't necessarily. Okay, here we go. All right. I'm going to move over here so I can show you these pictures there. All right. So this is a photograph of where she is staying. This is from inside this apartment. She's in the third floor. And for those of you who are not seeing the pictures, it looks like, it looks like an abandoned building in the middle of nowhere. So, so there are the photographs. And then here's the picture of the room that she's staying in. She said there are four adults and a child. And, yeah. I mean, like that. It's kind of crowded. Let me read you the description. And then today she went out. So she said, there are two rooms. We are five people. Tomorrow, two more people will arrive. But they don't shoot here, she wrote. Okay. And so my heart broke at that line. There are two rooms. We are five people. Two more come tomorrow. But they don't shoot here. Ay. And then so that was the last thing from yesterday. And then this morning, I wrote to her. I said, hi, Tatiana, just checking in to see how you're doing today. The news is all over the place. Some coverage says that all this will be the end of Putin and Moscow could fall in a few weeks. Others say that Kyiv could fall any day now. I think they're all guessing. But it does seem that the Russian soldiers are untrained, don't have fuel or food, and there are many defections. I hope that's true. And she wrote back, she said, "Hello, my good friend. I believe in truth number two. I have many friends. They defend Kyiv, Kherson there. They say that the Russians are coming, but that they run out of fuel and their equipment that consumes 200 liters per 100 kilometers stalls. And they go to the villages, to the grandmother asking for food. Their food from the state expired in 2015. The food, the MREs, I guess, meals ready to eat that they were given by the Russian military, was all expired in 2015. She said, we can't believe it anymore. And the country was called number two in military equipment. She said, I can't tell you what's happening in my chats. There are a lot of them. Everyone who stayed in Ukraine says that they will help rebuild the city. Everyone who is now defending is ready to go to the end. We are Cossacks, she wrote. We are superheroes, like in your Marvel comics, followed by a few smiley faces. We can handle it, she said, I believe with all my heart. So it sounds like she's getting a little regrouped, a little re-energized in this new place. I'm trying to see what else I want to share with you. Okay. So then I told you I asked about calling. I said, no pressure, but whenever you're ready, I have a lot of people who want to hear from you. They care about you. And she said, in one moment, I will be ready. I know how important it is for you and for the world. I'm not ready just yet because I forget words very much. Guests are calling me now. I speak English with them like in the first grade of school. I confuse everything. I want to convey the truth to people, not just sound. The moment will come and we can call by video. By the way, I did tell her her English is wonderful. In fact, I said no rush. One line that she said was just incredible. But I showed you earlier the video from inside the apartment. Now she went outside. So I want to show you what the outside looks like. And again, as stark, and there is some audio on this, but as stark as it looked before. So she said she went outside for the first time today, first time in days. And here's the video she shot. It's just, it's like a deserted village. And it looks like a rundown part of town.
Вон там ми живем.
Yeah, and that you can see she's zooming in on the apartment they're staying, the third floor. She said it's actually an old factory. Not so much an apartment, but an old factory. It's just amazing. Absolutely. Absolutely amazing. All right, I do want to find, you know, where I told her English is beautiful. She had one line that was almost poetry. And let me see if I can't find it. So she said, here, through the wall, we have five families with small children living on 40 square meters. And then she showed me another video that looked like in a cute little house. And she said, this is my close friend. I'm the godmother of this boy. They live in Kyiv. We came here against what they said, that there is nowhere to hide from military equipment. Then she said, this child was in Kyiv for 5 days, hiding under a 20-story building. And then the parents found gasoline to leave. It's very bad with gasoline in Kyiv. They pour only 20 liters. With very large traffic jams, sometimes people can't leave the city for 6 to 7 hours and the gasoline runs out. And then people go on foot. But with a small child, it's grief. It's minus 0 degrees outside and it's snowing. And she said, but we are together now. We have a lot of food. There is no shortage in this region. And I'm like, oh, thank God. I said, I'm so glad to hear that. I hope you're feeling a little more relaxed and more importantly, that you're out of the line of fire. And here's the line that she wrote back. For someone who says she doesn't have a good command of the English language, listen to this. She wrote, it still hurts, but it's actually easier to breathe. It doesn't compress the heart so much. It still hurts, but it's already easier to breathe. It doesn't compress the heart so much. Wow. So anyway, that's the story on Tatiana. They're at this little village. It is very remote area. It sounds like that area is not being bombed. They do have food. She felt good enough to venture outside for a little bit today. And her heart doesn't feel like it's being compressed so much. I wake up and I think about her, and the first thing I do is write a message. We will meet one of these days. So that's the story with Tatiana. Oh, David's walking in there. Hi.
Hi. I don't mean to rain on your parade with your new BFF.
Yeah.
However, you know, she mentioned we are Cossacks.
Yes.
Cossacks are the ones who conducted the pogroms.
Oh.
And you heard about Putin bombing Babi Yar the other day?
Yes, I did.
That's in Ukraine.
I know it is.
Most of those 30,000 people that were killed over 2 days that were Jews, they weren't shot by Germans. They were shot by Ukrainians.
Okay, but when was that? You know what? I don't want to do this with you right now. She's not one of them.
I understand, but using the term Cossack, I'm sorry.
Well, but maybe, I don't know. I got you. Okay. Thanks for raining on my parade.
You didn't mention the other thing that we did this weekend. Watching West Side Story.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Okay, so I watched two movies this weekend. We watched West Side Story. Now, can I just say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Steven Spielberg, what the fuck did you do? He took, like, one of the best musicals of all time and did a cheap imitation. No, an expensive imitation. If you haven't seen it, I guess it's streaming for free now if you have HBO Max. Wow. It's, first of all, it doesn't ever end. It goes on for like 3 hours, and it was unnecessary. Go watch the original. It's all you need. On the other hand, there's this movie, Coda, which I didn't watch when I first saw it pop up. It's on Apple Plus, and then I saw it was nominated for a few Oscars, and I watched it. It's about this girl. She's the only hearing girl in her family, the only hearing person in her family. Her parents and her brother are all deaf. And I won't give it away, but watch it. Oh my God. So good. So there's my movie reviews for the day. Skip West Side Story. Watch Coda. Got it? Okay. All right. A liter is a bit more than a quart, right? Yeah. So, yeah. So I understand what David was saying, but she's not a Nazi. I can tell you that. And we've had enough conversations. Maybe, you know, Cossacks, maybe that's the line she came from. I don't know. But yeah, leave it up to a man to spoil a good mood, you know. All right. I keep glancing over here to watch for Ellie Mistal, who's scheduled to join us at the bottom of the hour. So it's now 5:22. So we've got a few more minutes. Will Rita Moreno shake her head? I don't know. She was the best part of the movie. She sang There's a Place for Us, which was their Tony and Maria song. What?
I was not trying to say that she's a Nazi.
Okay.
I was saying that the term is triggering, and Ukrainians are notoriously anti-Semitic.
I gotcha. Well, she's
There's
not.
Ellie Mistal.
I know Ellie's here, so I gotta
and
get.
West Side Story was like watching a cover band.
West Side Story sucked out loud. I gotta tell you, my God, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Really, my goodness, there was no need for that. Go back and watch the original, and say, you know, it's not like they even, you know, my theory on cover songs. Sorry, Ellie, I'm getting your shot up. As soon as I get your shot here, I'm going to bring you in. My theory on cover songs is this. If you're going to cover a masterpiece, then make it your own. Do something with it. Make it brilliant. Make it, you know, add something to it. If you're just going to sing the same exact notes and play it, why? Why bother? Well, watch the original. It's not necessary. Oh, shit. Okay, so now I see what happened. Okay, Ellie, bear with me 1 second, because for whatever reason, your video is not coming up. Oh, I see why. All right, this should do it. I was all set. I can bring up your audio. Hi, Ellie.
Tonight, I'll do your show tonight. Sorry.
That was better than what I saw on the stupid thing. I'm not able to bring your video in here. Why is that? All right, this really sucks.
I can see you.
I know you can. Hi. All right. So we're going to talk while I keep trying to troubleshoot. It's always something. You know, if it's not one thing, it's another. Ellie Mastalis, I can bring up your graphic. I'll put it up with the blank side of the screen that's yours. Ellie Mastal is the justice correspondent for The Nation magazine. His new book is out. It came out just last week. It's called Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. But I really want to get your video up here, and it's always something. I'll figure this out. Anyway, while I'm getting this going, Ellie Mastal, thank you for joining us. I got to ask, so I read, you know, you read the book, you open it up, and on the very first page of the introduction, it says, is it the introduction or the first page of the first chapter? Either way, in one of these first pages, it says the Constitution is trash. You basically say it. So when you go on The View and you say the Constitution is trash, why were they surprised?
It's the very first line of my book is yes. The Constitution is not good.
Right.
The very last line of the book is I'm here to tell you the Constitution is trash. Republicans are the ones who say it always has to stay that way.
Right.
So like the frame of the book is that what I am retorting to in the title of the book is the white slaver and colonist Constitution that we are saddled with. I'm not ashamed of talking about that, right, Nicole?
And right.
It's been weird to me to get some of the reaction, because I kind of want to be like, has anybody actually read this thing? Like, just the veneration that people have for this parchment. It's religious, right, as opposed to something rational and logical and whatever, right?
Exactly.
You can like there are lots of ideas in the Constitution that I like. You know, there are lots of concepts there that I think are useful. The problem is that the ideas and concepts in the Constitution have never been applied to everybody who's living here equally, like not even for a day, right? We haven't just to see how it feels, right? We haven't even had a Taco Tuesday where all the ideas in this document have been applied to everybody. And because the Constitution doesn't require that all of its ideas or ideals are lived up to, I think it's a pretty weak document overall.
Well, exactly. And it makes a lot of sense. And if you know, maybe they need some new producers over at The View, because it seemed like they didn't even know what the premise of the book was. Like, why were they shocked?
I thought the ladies at The View were great. Sunny had read the book, and we had a really good discussion about
it. She was back there
backstage. And I didn't think I think that the hosts on The View were a little bit surprised that like I would be so bold on television, because I do think that a lot of people, even a lot of people who agree with me, generally find nicer ways to say that under the bright light. So I think they were a little bit surprised that I said it, but I didn't feel like they were mean, or I was really thankful for the opportunity to go on and talk with them. I thought they were great, and I had a good time. I had a good time talking to the audience. It's really just been the Twitter reaction that's been like, really, guys? Really? From, you know, there we go.
Hi.
From conservative media, and that's not entirely surprising as well. Like, the conservative media, which doesn't have intellectual capacity, the gravitas to engage with my arguments, are instead coming at me for, you know, slogans or the way that I look or whatever. That's not in my career. That has not been all that surprising. It's a little bit disappointing, but I'm not, you know, I can't say that I'm surprised by it.
Right. But if they have just looked at the book cover, see what you look like. So anyway, you're making a really good point.
But can I just say, Nicole, that's again the other point. Like, so they're criticizing me for something I said on The View that's literally the first line of my book.
Right.
And then they're criticizing me for how I look when my face is on
the cover of the book.
These people not get... I know what I look like. I kind of thought this through, and like, I'm not embarrassed about the points that I have to make or my physical being.
Right. Well, you know, welcome to the club, because when they swarm, when I get attacked by the crazies on Twitter, 9 times out of 10, they come at me about my appearance. I'm fat, I'm old, I'm ugly. Really? That's what you got? Go away. You know, that's ridiculous. Bring an argument. But if you want to talk about my appearance, first of all, who the fuck asked you? And second of all, have you looked in a mirror lately? I promise you, I haven't seen you, but chances are you don't look a whole lot better. Bring some substance, man.
And it's like, it's not like I don't give them stuff to talk about, right? I have viewpoints that one reasonable people might disagree.
Mm-hmm.
Like we could have a conversation on the substance if they were able to kind of intellectually lock in and engage at that level. They're not. And so that's why we get this, this particular pushback again. Like it's not something that I didn't anticipate even when I was writing it. Cause I knew that a lot of conservatives haven't kind of thought about this document the way that I have, but I didn't write it for them. Right. And that's the other thing, right? It's not like I'm trying to change the conservative mind. I'm not trying to change the mind of people who can't even accept that maybe a document written by slavers isn't the best thing that we have, since sliced bread. Right.
Right.
The reason why I wrote it is to make some of these concepts way more accessible to people who haven't been to law school, who don't have legal training, because frankly, I think that it's liberals who too often cede ground, cede legal ground that we need not cede to the conservative viewpoint. And I wrote the book so that people could understand the law more for sure, but also so that liberals could kind of start thinking about a different way to fight for the law and to fight for our values.
Without a doubt. So let's talk a few specifics here. Ellie Mistal, in the book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, you know, your premise is reasonable. It goes to follow that if you, the Constitution was written by a bunch of white men, that no women weighed in on this. No people of color weighed in on this. We were never asked, does this work for you? So at some point, it should have been updated, right? That's the easiest. That's the ground floor. But at best, any document like this should be kind of a living document by which it's updated. It keeps up with the times. First of all, I read this thing and I want to say, did people back then actually talk like this? Did they speak like this? The way that the Constitution is written? Because it's not plain English.
I'm not as knowledgeable about archaic forms of like 18th century parts of speech. I'm not a linguist. I assume that there were parts of the, when I read the Federalist Papers, right, mm-hmm. those were definitely made to be popularly understood, and they're just as convoluted as some of the constitutional language. It's just like that. I point out, for instance, the Eighth Amendment, our Eighth Amendment, they didn't come up with that. They just copy and pasted that from the English Bill of Rights from the 17th century. Right?
Uh-huh.
One of the pushbacks that I've gotten is that people have said, well, it has been updated, right? And I say, yeah, the amendments are great. Who got to write those?
Touche. Now, the other part of it, if it was so great before it ever got out of the box, before the horses left the gate, they had to add 10 things, the first 10 amendments. The Bill of Rights were basically addendums to the Constitution before it ever became effective.
Right, so I called it a day one patch in the book, right?
So they
knew the Constitution was so broken on release, they had to immediately update it, right? That's number one. Then we had to fight a civil war. That's how ridiculous that form of government was. I count that as a demerit. Then after the Civil War, you make all of these changes and everybody's like, oh, it's changed. Oh, those work so well that they ignored and still had an apartheid state going on in the South for another 100 years after the war until there was another uprising, another this time peaceful uprising. That was in the 60s, right? So that's another demerit to even make the Civil War amendments have any kind of gumption, whatever. And then that the civil rights movement works so well that within 45 years, you go from an oppressed people to having the first black president, which is awesome. And America reacted to that so strongly that they replaced the first black president with a bigoted con man. And when that bigoted con man was thrown out of office, his people launched a coup.
Yeah.
Which, again, I count as a demerit when we're talking about, like, constitutional government, right?
Right.
So, like, even when we talk about the amendments and the changes and the addendums, what we still fundamentally have is a country written by white men for white men, interpreted only by white men. And that's the last point that I make on this amendments issue. We've had the final arbiter of what the Constitution says when there is ambiguity is the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
We can disagree about how we've gotten there, but it is where we are. Right. The Supreme Court decides what the Constitution actually means. There have been 115 Supreme Court justices in American history. 108 of them have been white men. So even when we're talking about the amendments, even when we're talking about the living, breathing, evolving document, we're still fundamentally talking about laws written by white men, for white men, interpreted by white men and for white men, where everybody else basically hasn't been allowed to play.
Right.
And that, I think, is a problem.
Right. And for those who say, look, the problems have been corrected. There are the amendments. Well, I'm a woman. Tomorrow is International Women's Day. Guess what we still don't have in this lovely document here?
Equal Rights Amendment.
Thank you. All men are created equal. Well, that's bullshit, but all women are not. So it's bullshit on a few levels. So Ellie Mistal, what is your solution? Do we need a rewrite? Because there's been talk of a constitutional convention. Problem is, the people making the loudest noises are the idiots on the right who, I don't know what they want to do. The Constitution seems to be perfectly written for them, maybe not for us. I would think if anyone wants to rewrite it, it should be us. So what is their problem?
Yeah, I would be for a rewrite if I thought that we could get a constitutional convention that where all the people were represented proportionally and equally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. We would either do it based on some like ridiculous cockamamie state system that would just lock in the unfair disproportionate power white people have in the Senate. We just lock that in to another constitutional convention, which would be bad. Or we'd let, you know, it's like, how are we going to choose these delegates? We'd let corporations choose the delegates. It'd be very, like, however we got, if we could get to an actual representative body of Americans choosing, writing the new Constitution, I would be all for it. I just have absolutely no confidence that we could get there. And instead, we'd have a delegation that would lock in much of the unfairness that we currently see in the current Constitution. So my solution is in fact to use the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is the thing that has the final say on what the Constitution means. Then I think we need to flood the Supreme Court with people who think the Constitution means something better than it is.
Okay.
And that's where I always come back to. That's a whole different, you know, getting Democrats on board with that idea is at this point even harder than getting Republicans on board with that idea. Republicans understand that if they want things, they have to control the Supreme Court. I'm still trying to get Democrats to get that memo.
Right. Right. And the thing is, I think the Democrats are so, and I hate overgeneralization, but here I go. The thing that
the White House is knows what the deal is, right?
Right.
It's not everybody.
Got to. They've got to. But an overwhelming number of Democrats in Congress are so concerned with, you know, playing the bipartisan game that not appearing to be overstepping whatever artificial boundaries they think there are, that they're frozen with inaction. Now, the people on the other side, you know, you hear Mitch McConnell bitch, well, I don't see that they're really taking us into account. Well, when did the last guy ever take the Democrats into account? Why is it only the Democrats who have to worry about the feelings of the poor snowflake Republicans?
It's such an asymmetrical war. When Republicans
really
are in power, they use that power maximally. They don't care what other people think. They don't care what Democrats think. They don't care what the poll numbers think.
Right.
I mean, people forget the unprecedented obstruction of Merrick Garland polled poorly.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans didn't care. Putting an alleged attempted at rapist on the Supreme Court poured poorly. Brett Kavanaugh, the least supported Supreme Court justice since they started tracking that number. Republicans didn't care. Forcing a Supreme Court justice onto the court after the election had already started with Amy Coney Barrett poured poorly. They did it anyway.
Yep.
Republicans don't even care about the polls, much less consulting with the other party when it comes to their their court machinations, Democrats always do, or at least there are enough Democrats that always pretend to or suggest that they want to. And it's one of the reasons why Democrats are not as effective as Republicans. Democrats are not as effective because they're always trying to appease Republicans. Republicans are more effective because they don't give a damn about appeasing Democrats.
Right. Right.
Broke something in my house.
Uh oh. That's okay. I don't mean it's okay for, I mean, shit happens, but you know, I'm used to having dogs run through and barking, and we're cool here. Doesn't matter. I just hope everything's okay there. So Elie Mystal, the subtitle to the book is A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Now I've got plenty of bones to pick with it, but you are coming at it from obviously a different place than I am. We have different problems with this document. That is, but the fact remains, this document is so far from perfect. And depending on who you talk to, you know, you have the originalists who say that the word of these founders, who were flawed men, flawed white men, is infallible, that we have to, that for the next however many centuries this country might exist, and I know I'm being overly optimistic here by saying centuries, it could just be a matter of weeks the way we're going, that we have to go based on the feelings of these white men from 250 years ago?
Yeah, so first of all, it's a black guy's guide to the Constitution. It's not a guide to the Constitution for black people, right?
Like, gotcha.
The thing that I'm trying to do with that, as it suggests in the title, I'm looking at the Constitution from the perspective of a person the Constitution was designed to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gives you a little bit different perspective, right? Like, the thing wasn't written for me.
No.
And so I look at it a little bit with a little bit more skepticism, shall we say, about its true intent. But to your point, the issue with originalists is this, right? When there is ambiguity, we can debate what's ambiguous or not. That's a whole different kind of field of study, right? But when there is ambiguity, conservatives say we should go back to the original public meaning of the people who wrote the thing that is now ambiguous. So if you're talking about some, just like we were talking about before, if you're talking about some 1787 language that isn't clear what they mean by that, we should go back to 1787 and look at what people at the time thought. And I say, screw that, because the people at the time were horrible racists, rapists, slavers, colonists, and good white people who were still willing to make deals with horrible rapists, racists, slavers, and colonists, right? So, like, why would I care about how they interpreted the words of their awful time? I don't want their awful time to come back. I think it was a bad time, you know, for people, for many people, including everybody who looked like me, right?
Right.
So then the originalists will take that through, even through the amendments, right? So even when we get to like something like the 14th Amendment, instead of saying, okay, now we have to look at the original public meaning of 18th century white men, we look at the 14th Amendment and originalists will say, okay, now let's look at it from the perspective of 19th century white men. It's still white men.
Exactly. Right.
It's still white men who got to write it, interpret it, right? It's still white male legislatures that got to ratify it. People need to remember an amendment to the Constitution has to be ratified by 3/4 of the state legislatures. Do you know how many state legislatures in American history were majority minority controlled?
None.
Zero. You know how many state legislators in American history were controlled by women?
None.
One.
Oh, what? Really?
Nevada.
Nevada.
2018.
Oh, okay. I've gotcha.
All right.
That's, ding.
That's it.
Yes. Gotcha.
So even the states that are ratifying the amendments are dominated by white males. So I think looking at the original public meaning of the best available white people at the time is an intellectually bankrupt activity. And instead, we should look to the best available people of our time.
Mm-hmm.
All people of our time to interpret what these things mean or could mean or should mean, right?
Right.
When we talk about something, I have a whole chapter in the book. I think that the most obvious kind of breakpoint between originalism and progressivism is the Eighth Amendment, right? The Eighth Amendment says cruel and unusual punishment should be prohibited. The Constitution doesn't define what cruel and unusual mean. originalists say, well, let's go to the videotape. Let's go ask what James Madison and his ilk thought about Cruel and Unusual. And I say, you want me to ask the slavers?
Right.
What they thought was cruel?
Right, because they walk around with their whips, and I guess they thought that was okay in right? some these, demented fashion.
These people used to stick firecrackers yeah. up the backsides oh, of black people. I'm supposed to ask them what they think okay punishments are. Nah.
Right.
Nah. Right. I will ask a comic book. I will ask Kal-El. I will ask lots and lots of documents before I go all the way back to Thomas freaking Jefferson and figure out what he thought was cruel and unusual because he's lost his credibility on that particular issue, if you ask me.
Yeah, I'd say so. I would say so. You know, and even something is, look, we all know the words of the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, they could have written that to make it a little more English friendly. But, you know, even to my non-legal ears, a well-regulated militia, to me, this sounds like it's the National Guard shall have the right to be armed to do the duties of the National Guard. That's the well-regulated militia. Kyle Rittenhouse going into Kenosha, Wisconsin with an AR-15, there's nothing regulated about that. It's not a militia in the terms of being regular. He shouldn't have got off. He killed a man. So, this is open to interpretation. And I might say if we're not going to rewrite it, maybe we need to better interpret it. But then it falls, as you say, Ellie, to the Supreme Court. And now we've got a real Supreme Court problem. So it was two seats for sure. And I'll even throw in a third, I think, was stolen. And, you know, what they were willing to do for their people, for Amy Coney Barrett, push her through in what days before the election, and now some of them are raising a red flag about anybody that Joe Biden might nominate. That's some grade A bullshit. That's the hypocrisy you're talking about. And so the solution is to do what is not actually mentioned in the Constitution at all, because it doesn't say how many justices are on the Supreme Court. It's to fill it with people so it could be more balanced and a bit more fair. That's the goal, right?
Article 3 of the Constitution says that the Supreme Court, there shall be a Supreme Court of the United States, and it shall be organized by Congress, and federal judges shall serve while in good behavior.
Huh.
That's it, folks. It says that there's lifetime tenure. It says that Congress controls everything else about how the Supreme Court is organized. And that means that we can have as many justices as Congress wants. Mm-hmm. We started with 6. We went to 7, then we went to 8, then we went to 9, then we went to 10, then we went back down to 7, then we went to 9 again, and that's where we've been since 1850.
But you forget, Ellie, we went to 8. The Republican Party under Mitch McConnell put it back to 8 for the better part of a year on his own whim because he didn't want to put Obama's nominee on the court. So
went to 8 as long as black people were president.
That's right.
So the number of justices can be changed, and I think they should be changed. And I think that changing the number of justices is historically what one does when the Supreme Court gets completely out of whack of where the rest of the country is. The normal pushback that I get from that is liberals saying, well, if we expand the Supreme Court, well, then Republicans, when they get in control, they'll just expand the Supreme Court right back. To which I say, how is that worse?
Right. Exactly.
How is that worse?
Go for it.
We are now.
The more the better.
Right now we're losing 6-3. If we make it 13-6 and then later Republicans come back and make it 16-13, how is that worse than where we are now?
It's not.
But in the meantime, having a 13-6 court, having, you know, a 20-6 court or whatever, however you want to, many people you want to put on it. I advocate for 29 justices.
Do you?
Makes it a lot harder for Republicans to ever take back control of all of government again, which they would need to do in order to re-expand the Supreme Court, because a liberal Supreme Court would protect a little thing that I like to call voting rights.
That little thing that nobody seems to be very concerned about right now.
And it turns out that when everybody votes, when everybody who wants to vote can vote and have their vote counted, it turns out when everybody has a frictionless access to voting, it's very, very hard for Republicans to win because they are an unpopular minority party.
They are.
And so if you expand the Supreme Court so that it protects voting rights, then it's very hard for Republicans to ever take back control of that body again. Case in point, what was the Republican legal response to Barack Obama? Beyond the birth certificate stuff and the Kenya stuff and whatever, was the legal response to Barack Obama? It's 2013. It's John Roberts eviscerating the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, and don't let him do anything.
The Voting Rights Act in 2013 that then sets the conditions for Trump to get a narrow victory in 2016. That is John Roberts understanding that the way to keep Republicans in control fundamentally is to suppress votes and to suppress laws that allow people to vote. So that's the Republican response.
Yep.
If you have a Democratic-controlled Supreme Court, then they expand voting rights, they knock down racist gerrymanders, and then we see if Republicans can win on a fair playing field. So far, they haven't.
Right. You know, Ellie Mastal, I need to back up to something you said. You said Congress, according to the Constitution, has control over the Supreme Court as long as the justices are in good behavior or something like that. What word did you use? What phrase?
Good behavior.
Good behavior. Okay. Well, can we talk about Clarence Thomas for a moment, please? Because I don't think he operates on good behavior. I think, first of all, he fudged his financial disclosure forms and never declared the money that his wife was bringing in as a partisan Republican political activist. I mean, this woman raised money for the buses to go to D.C. on January 6th. She is pulling political strings, and he doesn't recuse himself from anything she's involved with. I would say that Clarence Thomas does not operate under good behavior, and if the tables were turned, I don't think he'd still be on the court.
So, ideologically, the judge that I oppose the most is Samuel Alito.
Okay.
He's a jerk.
Yes, he is.
Like he's a mean person, right?
Yes, he is.
He's a theocrat. Yeah. He believes in aggrandized state power for Republicans and none for Democrats. Like he's a hypocrite.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that I say about Alito that impugns his character.
Okay.
Samuel Alito has the character to be a Supreme Court justice. I just think he happens to be wrong about almost everything.
Gotcha. I'm with
Clarence
you.
Thomas is ethically compromised. Brett Kavanaugh is morally compromised. These two people are different than Alito and Gorsuch, who I could spend the rest of my life disagreeing with on policy.
Oh, yeah.
Thomas and Kavanaugh have different kinds of problems. And those problems, unfortunately, can only be handled through the congressional process of impeachment, because the Congress has written no other laws, which they could, to put ethical strictures on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is the only court in America that operates without an ethics code.
Mm-hmm.
Every other court that you can think of, you can go to a traffic court in Peoria, and there's an ethics code for that traffic judge, not for Kavanaugh,
really?
Not for Clarence Thomas,
really?
Not for his wife, Jenny Thomas, which is the only reason they can get away with that.
Wow.
Because if the traffic court judge in Peoria, Illinois, was if his wife was out there fundraising for people who showed up at traffic court, that would be an ethical violation and the judge would have to recuse himself. But on the Supreme Court, that same problem, Jenny Thomas fundraising for people, pinning literal medals on people who are about to show up in her husband's courtroom, because the Supreme Court has no ethical guidelines. Nothing bad can happen to Clarence Thomas unless Congress decides to impeach him, which we know they don't have the strength or will to do.
They don't have the backbone to do. Right.
You know, because if they did, because he's been doing this for 30 years.
Right.
And they haven't said
hasn't
Boudet.
Bothered them yet. Right. That's astounding that there's no ethics rules for the Supreme Court. How do we change that?
Congress. Congress. But
so we need a Congress.
Here's the thing, Nicole. And this is a good way to kind of close it out. One of the reasons why there's an asymmetry between Republicans and Democrats on the Supreme Court is that Republican voters vote on the Supreme Court, and too often, Democratic voters don't vote on the Supreme Court, right?
Yep.
So you cannot win a Republican primary for Senate,
or president without being super strong on the Supreme Court. I take you back to 2016. Donald Trump, outsider. He's anti-establishment. He's making fun of the Bush family. He's calling Mexicans criminals and rapists. Mm-hmm. He's doing all these outside-the-box crazy things. But when it comes to the court, nah. He went and got himself a list from the Federal Society that was straight Republican establishment center mass. No craziness there. Wasn't trying to nominate his sister married Trump Barry, or his daughter Ivanka. Wasn't trying to do any of that. Just these very standard Republican justices, because if he hadn't, that would have cost him the nomination.
Right.
Republicans don't play around when it comes to that. Fast forward to 2020. Democrat, you know, every Democrat and their mother is running for president, right? We got Bernie, we got the Coffin Man, we got all these people, right? We got Mayor Stop and Frisk, all these people running, right? Joe Biden is one of the most conservative persons when it comes to the Supreme Court. A former head of the Senate Judiciary Committee is the most opposed to court packing, is the most conservative when it comes to thinking about reforming the court. It costs him zero votes. It cost Biden nothing to have that concern. Pete Buttigieg had a whole plan to expand the Supreme Court. Didn't pick him up vote. Joe Biden had no plan. Cost him nothing. That's how Democrats roll.
Yeah.
Barack Obama comes up, you know, first black president, 2008. His chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, while they're trying to pass Obamacare, literally says to a reporter, "I don't give a fuck about judges." That's a Rahm Emanuel. I'm sorry for the language.
But that's fine.
I'm quoting Rahm Emanuel. You can't get away from that language. That's his quote in 2008.
Wow.
So, like, this is the problem with Democrats. We don't, you know, we don't hold our politicians to account on the third branch of government the way Republicans do. And so then obviously our politicians don't care about the third branch of government as much as Republicans do. Why would they? It never cost them an election.
Amazing. It's amazing. I still have a button from the 2012 election, and it was from the People for the American Way, and it was like a stick drawing of the Supreme Court, and it just said, "It's the Supreme Court, stupid Obama, right? 2012. I've kept it for all these years because I knew it's the Supreme Court, stupid. But we can't get that message out. And now we have this. And now I live in Florida where they just, I think the idiot death sentence signed into law a bill outlawing abortions at 15 weeks.
My entire thing in 2016 was telling liberals who had been Bernie people after Hillary won the nomination. Mm-hmm. My entire thing for that entire last bit of the campaign was Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 82 years old.
Yes.
That's right. All you need to know.
Hey, I'm still a Bernie person. I voted for Hillary Clinton and I voted for Joe Biden, even though they were not my first, second, third, or fifth choices.
Joe Biden was eighth on my
there
ballot.
You go.
But you know what? Like, you don't play around with the third branch of government because these people are appointed for life.
Exactly. And that's, I don't know what it's going to take to get people to understand the writing on the wall. So here we are. Do you have any, I hate to end on a negative note, maybe it won't be, any optimism that we're not going to go down this really dark, horrible road in the next few years?
No, I think one of the only ways that things, I'm afraid that the only way things are going to get better from now is that they're going to have to get a lot worse. You know, Republicans are about to get everything they wanted. They're about to kill abortion rights. They're about to unleash guns on subways. That's coming this term. They're about to end affirmative action. They're about to kill environmental regulations. Republicans are about to get everything they wanted. And my only hope is that as we live in the dystopia that Republicans want, more people are like, wow, it sucks here. Maybe we should do something about it.
Yeah. I'll probably be gone by then. How about this? How about we get rid of Democratic leadership in the House? You know, the average age right now is I'm in the 80s somewhere. Maybe we tell Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, Jim Clyburn, you've done a lovely lifetime of service. Now you go home and let the next generation take over. It's their asses on the line for the next 40, 50 years. You won't be here. How about turning it over to them and let them try to make things better?
If I was rewriting the Constitution, I would have term limits in there. I'm just saying. Term limits for federal officials. That would be a constitutional thing if I was writing it. I'm just saying.
Okay, so you don't disagree with me. Like, time for them to go home.
I think in general, Nancy Pelosi does a great job. I do think that, you know, there are issues. There are places where I disagree with her politics, but I can never disagree with her competence. And right. I think that, you know, I always want to give her credit for that. But like, look, this is why we fight. This is why we have elections. The point of constitutional law is to establish the guardrails. And I feel like our Constitution is really weak when it comes to establishing guardrails. There would be no problem with having, I mean, how many terms are enough? Pick a number. But yeah. Whatever that number is, write it down and say, like, after 3, 4, 5, 6 terms, we're gonna rotate, you know, we're gonna stir the pot a bit. Like, I don't see why that would be a problem.
I don't see why either. And I wish the people would listen to us. I often say, look, Democrats are great because we don't take the talking points. We don't take what other people tell us to say and make that our statement. We have minds of our own. We need to get in lockstep on certain things, and saving the nation maybe is one of them, and making the Constitution a bit more fair as well. Ellie Mistal, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, is out now. Read it. And Ellie, it is always a pleasure. I love having you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Nicole. Have a nice one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The awesome Ellie Mistal. And find him on Twitter at Ellie, E-L-I-E-N-Y-C. And, of course, at The Nation. TheNation.com. Okay. I think with that, we're about done. Sorry for the technical problems. YouTube, I saw that your audio list for a couple of minutes there. I'm so sorry. I was trying to get Ellie's picture up. Best laid plans and all that. Always something. All right, you know what I didn't get to do is read you this editorial from the Sunset. I think I need to do that. So we'll go over just a couple of minutes because I got to share this with you. So the South Florida Sun Sentinel, I guess this will be in the paper tomorrow. They put it up on their website just moments really before I came on the air. Oh, maybe an hour, but you know, it's still moments. Anyway, it has to do with our idiot governor. And the headline, 3:59 p.m., so 1 hour before showtime. DeSantis sacrifices Floridians for his personal ambition, reads the headline. And the editorial goes like this. As author Bob Woodward tells the story, the new virus in China didn't yet have a name in early 2020, but Donald Trump's national security advisor, Robert O'Brien, warned him of, quote, the biggest national security threat you face in your presidency. The warning proved accurate. Nearly a million U.S. deaths later, COVID-19 may be waning, but the question of the next viral pandemic is not if, but when. In barely a century, there have been the misnamed Spanish flu, HIV/AIDS, and now COVID-19. When the next pandemic strikes, America will need a president who acts wisely, based on science and not politics. That president should prefer to err on the side of safety rather than popularity. Governor Ron DeSantis would not be that president. Although he doesn't admit it, DeSantis's craving for the White House is the most transparent ambition since Julius Caesar theatrically declined a crown. And it's already dreadfully clear what kind of public health president he would be. Consider what happened Monday. DeSantis's Surgeon General Joseph Latipo announced that the Department of Health will not recommend healthy children get COVID-19 vaccinations and will, in fact, recommend against it. You hear this one? Against it. That was another irresponsible act in DeSantis's full-bore campaign to undercut common sense health measures as invasions of freedom. As governor, DeSantis has dealt with the coronavirus with less responsibility than Trump did at the White House. But Florida's fringe surgeon general would likely become the nation's fringe surgeon general if President DeSantis could promote him. Oh, my God. God forbid. Doubling down on a reckless radical agenda, Latipo now says that healthy Florida children age 5 to 11 should not continue to get a CDC-approved vaccine, making Florida the first state to actively discourage kids from being protected. Children are far less likely than adults to die from COVID-19, but they do die from it, 42 in Florida so far, according to the Department of Health. Even if mildly ill or asymptomatic, they could infect vulnerable grandparents. But thanks to DeSantis and the unquestioning Florida legislature, Florida schools cannot require masks, even in high-risk counties. The zealotry of DeSantis and Latipo for the freedom to go maskless and now unvaccinated in the face of a still lethal virus is red meat for the governor's right-wing followers, and it's rocket fuel for his lucrative national fundraising. He exposed sheer hypocrisy during a notorious photo op where he bullied a group of Tampa high school students into removing masks, scoffing at, quote, COVID theater. Is it a matter of personal choice and parental control, as he keeps saying, or not? Even as the Centers for Disease Control was relaxing its face mask protocols to account for improving local conditions, DeSantis and Latipo urged Floridians to, quote, buck the CDC. They also appeared to encourage physicians to prescribe remedies not approved by the FDA for antivirus therapy and to file complaints against hospitals that forbid questionable therapies. Just the other day, Latipo denounced as a lie that masks have saved any lives from COVID-19. That is as great a falsehood as Trump's claim to have won the election. Again, I'm reading the editorial from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. It continues. He labeled as zombies doctors who disagreed with him. DeSantis previewed a dystopian future as he took his campaign for the White House to the 2022 Conservative Political Action Conference in Orlando. Arriving with a rock star's welcome, he continued demonizing Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Biden's chief medical advisor, for his tireless efforts to protect Americans from COVID-19. He denounced Australia and Canada as threats to freedom for their efforts to control the pandemic. He was too busy demonizing medical science that day to say a word about Russia's diabolical invasion of Ukraine. DeSantis is running like Trump did in 2016 as a divider rather than a uniter, writing off moderate and liberal voters whom he has no more intention of representing in Washington than he has in Tallahassee. With COVID-19, DeSantis dragged Florida deeper into harm's way. He signed legislation to prohibit employers, schools, and other public agencies from imposing vaccine or mask mandates. He abdicated his duty as a leader by refusing to say whether he'd had a booster shot. He encouraged lax practices by nursing homes and other healthcare providers by signing and extending a law generally barring COVID-related lawsuits. He continues to disparage best practices. In all those ways, DeSantis was more irresponsible than Trump. The former president failed in his duty by minimizing the virus in his public statements and by undercutting his government's own safety pronouncements with White House and campaign events that did not enforce social distancing or face masking. But his Operation Warp Speed did make available a vaccine in record time, and he did not actively oppose federal, state, or local prevention efforts like DeSantis has. He's a ruthless politician who will knowingly sacrifice anything, especially truth, to his incandescent personal ambition. Simply put, if you liked having Trump in the White House, you'll love DeSantis. Let that simmer for a while. That editorial is from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. It was posted on their website this afternoon. It will be in the newspaper tomorrow. Everybody needs to share that everywhere. And in fact, I will, because it's behind a paywall, I will post the text. I'll copy and paste it on the blog today where I post today's show, which you want to share anyway because it was Ellie Mastal. So it'll be posted in just about a half hour at NicoleSandler.com/3-7-22 because that's today's date. All right. Got it? All right. So tomorrow is Tuesday. Tomorrow also happens to be International Women's Day. Gotta Laugh will be here. And if we're really good, we might even get a reunion of the Glibberal Goddesses. Maybe. Okay. So I'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place, same everything. And thank you for listening, everyone. It's got to get better, right? Have a good night. Since we started watching the Kurt Vonnegut documentary that's on Prime, And I'm a huge Kurt Vonnegut fan. Read my first Kurt Vonnegut book in high school and never looked back when I got to college because I had already gotten my freshman stuff out of the way during my senior year of high school. I was able to take whatever English class I wanted. And sure enough, they had studies in Vonnegut. My first English course at the college level, and it was Kurt Vonnegut. So I will leave you with his immortal words, and I guess it's the attitude I'm going to take on from now on. So it goes. See you tomorrow, everybody. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
This is what war looks like in all of its horror. The New York Times featured it prominently on their homepage all day Sunday, and it's printed above the fold Monday on page A1 of the paper of record. It's a photograph of a mother and her two children lying dead on the ground while a Ukrainian soldier tries to save the man traveling with them. He later died. Cliff Levy, the New York Times deputy managing editor, called the paper's front page one of the most important of the war. New York Times diplomatic correspondent Edward Wong wrote on Twitter that the New York Times editors have made an important decision to put the photo by Lindsay Addario on the homepage. Again, he wrote, Russian forces fired mortar shells at hundreds of Ukrainian civilians as they fled. A mother and her two children were killed here. This is happening across Ukraine. Many residents tried to flee after a ceasefire was allegedly called to allow them to escape through these green corridors. The problem is that all of these so-called green corridors would lead to Russia itself or to Belarus, its ally. A spokesperson for Ukrainian President Zelensky called the move a completely immoral stunt by Moscow to use people's suffering to create a television picture as propaganda. Russia's announcement of another so-called humanitarian corridor came after 2 days over the weekend in which ceasefires failed to hold long enough to allow the escape of some of the hundreds of thousands of people trapped in the besieged city of Mariupol without food or water. The United Nations Refugee Agency said 1.5 million people had fled Ukraine since Russia invaded 10 days ago. According to the UN, at least 364 civilians have been killed, 759 injured since attacks began on February 24th. U.S. officials are now joining the cries, saying they have seen credible reports of Russia intentionally attacking civilians and are documenting those actions. Now, although U.S. officials generally agree that Americans should not engage in boots-on-the-ground fighting, many in Congress are expressing support for the transfer of fighter jets to Ukraine from former Warsaw Pact countries, including Poland. Senators Rob Portman and Jean Shaheen sent a letter to the administration asking President Biden to negotiate a deal in which any older planes transferred to Ukraine from Eastern European countries would be replaced with American fighter jets. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Sunday that he's already working on the deal. Now, despite media and internet blackouts and strict guidelines surrounding what reporters can and can't say in Russia about the fighting, many Russians are somehow getting around the propaganda and are taking to the streets in protest. Reuters reporting the police in Russia detained at least 4,300 people at anti-war protests across Russia on Sunday alone. About 1,700 of them were arrested in Moscow. Videos posted on social media showed thousands of protesters in different cities angry about Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Demonstrators chanting, "No to war," and "Shame on you," among others. One of the dozens of protesters arrested in the Ural city of Yekaterinburg was shown being beaten by police. One of the consequences of this war is another rise in oil prices. Oil prices have now soared to their highest level in 13 years, raising fears about a bigger spike in inflation that could further damage the global economy. According to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, this surge is due to delays in the potential return of Iranian crude to the global markets and as the U.S. and European allies consider banning Russian oil imports. If Russia's oil exports are cut off, experts say it would put more strain on an already tight oil market, resulting in even higher gas prices across the country. The average price for a gallon of regular gas
in the U.S. hit $4 on Sunday, the highest level since 2008. There are now 18 states plus Washington, D.C., where the price of gas is $4 a gallon or higher. The highest prices are being seen in California, where the statewide average stands at $5.29 a gallon. So what do you do when gas is that expensive? Well, if you're one of these truckers, you waste it. Yeah. A bunch of idiot truckers burning expensive fuel on the so-called People's Convoy of dozens of trucks with some minivans and other vehicles that on Sunday encircled Washington, D.C. and disrupted traffic flow. Why? To protest government coronavirus pandemic policies. Really? The organizers of the convoy, which was inspired by a protest that blocked the streets in Ottawa, Canada for 3 weeks, planned to have participants stay close together to slow down traffic as they did two laps around the Capitol Beltway before returning to a staging area in Maryland. But by the second lap on Sunday, the vehicles were spread so far apart that it reduced their effectiveness. So that's happening. Vice President Kamala Harris on Sunday marked the 57th anniversary of Bloody Sunday by walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, and urging Congress to pass federal voting rights legislation. Harris said the legislation is necessary to counter un-American voter registration laws approved in Republican-led states. Bloody Sunday, of course, was the day in 1965 where 600 people started a peaceful march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, to protest discrimination in voter registration. They were subsequently attacked by state and local lawmen with billy clubs and tear gas. 17 people were hospitalized after the clash, which marked a key moment in the civil rights movement. And I'm still wondering when that bridge is going to be renamed for the late Congressman John Lewis. Just asking. From the Here We Go Again files, government funding runs out Friday night, so Congress is again scrambling to pass an omnibus spending package, now made a bit larger, as it must also include aid for Ukraine, Russian oil, energy imports, and COVID relief. House Democrats plan to file the omnibus late Monday night or Tuesday and vote on the measure as soon as Wednesday, because the House is recessing Wednesday because of the Democratic retreat coming up next weekend. Ah, the Republicans are meeting too, so it's not all on the Democrats, but this is crazy. Already, House Democrats plan to introduce a massive spending bill. The bill includes roughly $10 billion to help bolster Ukraine, but also tax on about $22.5 billion in coronavirus relief money that Republicans, of course, widely oppose. Again, the pressure is on to pass this deal before Friday when the government funding expires. If a broad funding package doesn't move quickly, they will once again be forced to pass another short-term stopgap funding measure to avoid another shutdown. The official global death toll from COVID-19 now passed the 6 million mark on Monday as the pandemic enters its third year. And a reminder, it's not over. You can and still should take precautions. And a couple of Florida stories to close out what's news for today. Senator Marco Rubio is usually missing in action, but now we learn when he does show up, he screws up. Now Rubio is defending tweeting out a photo from an online meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, dismissing complaints that participants were asked not to post anything on social media out of concern for Zelensky's safety. Rubio said he posted it before being told not to. And no, he still hasn't taken it down. For those who think, oh, the former guy would have been better to deal with Putin in this scenario, think again. In a speech to elite Republican donors over the weekend, the former guy said the U.S. could, quote, put the Chinese flag on fighter jets, then use them to, quote, bomb the shit out of Russia. I'll just leave that there. And finally, we are now entering the final week of the horrific 2022 Florida legislative season. Students are mobilizing Monday as the Florida Senate votes on the Don't Say Gay bill. This bill would prohibit classroom discussion about sexual orientation or gender identity in Florida's primary schools. While defending the legislation, The governor's press secretary, Christina Pashaw, said, quote, "If you're against the anti-grooming bill, you are probably a groomer, or at least you don't denounce the grooming of 4 to 8-year-old children. Silence is complicity. This is how it works, Democrats, and I didn't make the rules," end quote. Are you kidding me? The bill provides parents the opportunity to sue if a school district withholds certain information from them about their child's well-being, or if their child is exposed to instruction on sexual orientation or gender identity deemed not age-appropriate. Florida, indeed. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.